Chapter 15. At some point I opened my eyes again, thinking I had heard voices. All around me, blue. I tried to blink, found I could only close my eyes and leave them closed. Sometime later, I opened my eyes again, turned my head to the right, and saw Cyverdon and the girls squatting on either side of a tick-tick board. So I was dreaming, or hallucinating. At least I no longer hurt, which, on consideration, was a bad sign. But I couldn't bring myself to care much. I closed my eyes again. I woke, finally. Actual wakefulness, and found myself in a small, blue-walled room. I lay in a bed, and on a bench beside it, Cyverdon sat, leaning against the wall, looking as though she hadn't slept recently. Or, that is to say, even more as though she hadn't slept recently than she usually did. I lifted my head. My arms and legs were immobilized by correctives. "You're awake," said Cyverdon. I set my head back down. "Where's my pack?" "Right here." She bent, lifted it into my line of sight. "We're at the medical center in Terod," I guessed, and closed my eyes. "Yes. Do you think you can talk to the doctor, because I can't understand anything she says?" I remembered my dream. "You learn to play tick-tick." "That's different." "So, not a dream."
"You sold the flyer."
No answer.
"You bought Keth."
"No, I didn't," she protested. "I was going to, but when I woke up and you were gone..."
I heard her shift uncomfortably on the bench.
"I was going to find a dealer, but it bothered me that you were gone, and I didn't know where you were. I started to think maybe you'd left me behind."
"You wouldn't have cared once you took the Keth."
"But I didn't have the Keth," she said, voice surprisingly reasonable, "and then I went to the front and found you'd checked out."
"And you decided to find me and not the Keth," I said. "I don't believe you."
"I don't blame you."
She was silent for 5 seconds.
"I've been sitting here, thinking. I accused you of hating me because I was better than you."
"That's not why I hate you."
She ignored that. "Amat's grace, that fool. It was my own stupid fault. I was sure I was dead. And if it had been the other way around, I'd never have jumped to save anyone's life. You never knelt to get anywhere. You are where you are because you're fucking capable and willing to risk everything to do right. And I'll never be half what you are, even if I tried my whole life. And I was walking around thinking I was better than you, even half dead and no use to anyone, because my family is old, because I was born better."
"That," I said, "is why I hate you." She laughed, as though I'd said something moderately witty.
"If that's what you're willing to do for someone you hate, what would you do for someone you loved?"
I found I was incapable of answering. Fortunately, the doctor came in, broad, round-faced, pale, frowning slightly, slightly more when she saw me.
"It seems," she said, in an even tone that seemed impartial but implied disapproval, "that I don't understand your friend when he tries to explain what happened."
I looked at Cyverdon, who made a helpless gesture, and said,
"I don't understand any of it. I tried my best, and the whole day she's been giving me that look, like I'm biological waste she stepped in."
"It's probably just her normal expression." I turned my head back to the doctor. "We fell off the bridge," I explained. The doctor's expression didn't change.
"Both of you?"
"Yes." A moment of impassive silence, and then,
"It does not pay to be dishonest with your doctor."
And then, when I didn't answer,
"You would not be the first tourist to enter a restricted area and be injured. You are, however, the first to claim they'd fallen off the bridge and lived. I don't know whether to admire the brazenness or be angry you take me for such a fool."
Still, I said nothing. No story I could invent would account for my injuries in the way the truth did.
Members of military forces must register on arrival in the system.
The doctor continued. I remember hearing so.
Did you register?
No, because I am not a member of any military force.
Not quite a lie. I was not a member. I was a piece of equipment. A lone, useless fragment of equipment at that. This facility is not equipped, the doctor said, just a shade more sternly than the moment before, to deal with the sort of implants and augmentations you apparently have. I can't predict the results of the repairs I've programmed. You should see a doctor when you return home. To the Garantate.
That last sounded just slightly skeptical, the barest indication of the doctor's disbelief. I intend to go straight home once I leave here, I said, but I wondered if the doctor had reported us as possible spies. I thought not. If she had, likely she would have avoided expressing any sort of suspicion, merely waited for authorities to deal with us. She had not, then. Why not? A possible answer stuck her head into the room and called cheerily,
Breck, you're awake. Uncle's on the level just above. What happened? Your friend seemed like he was saying you jumped off the bridge, but that's impossible. Do you feel better?
The girl came fully into the room.
Hello, doctor. Is Breck going to be all right?
Breck will be fine. The corrective should drop off by tomorrow, unless something goes wrong. And with that cheerful observation, she turned and left the room.
The girl sat on the edge of my bed.
Your friend is a terrible tick-tick player. I'm glad I didn't teach him the gambling part, or he wouldn't have any money to pay the doctor with. It's your money, isn't it? From the flyer?
Cyverdon frowned.
What? What is she saying?
I resolved to check the contents of my pack as soon as I could. He'd have won it back playing counters. From the look on her face, the girl didn't believe that at all.
You really shouldn't go under the bridge, you know. I know someone who had a friend whose cousin went under the bridge, and someone dropped a piece of bread off, and it was going so fast it hit them in the head and broke their skull open and went into their brain and killed them.
I enjoyed your cousin's singing very much. I didn't want to reopen the discussion about what had happened.
Isn't she wonderful? Oh!
She turned her head, as though she heard something.
I have to go. I'll visit you again.
I'd appreciate that, I said, and she was out the door and away. I looked at Cyverdon. How much did this cost?
About what I got for the flyer, she said, ducking her head slightly,
maybe out of embarrassment, maybe something else. Did you take anything out of my pack?
That brought her head up again. No, I swear I didn't.
I didn't answer.
You don't believe me. Well, I don't blame you. You can check, as soon as your hands are free.
I intend to. But then what? She frowned, not comprehending, and of course she didn't understand. She had gotten as far as mistakenly evaluating me as a human being who might be worthy of respect. She had not, it seemed, come to the point of considering she might not actually be important enough for the Ratch to send a special missions officer after.
I was never assigned to find you, I said. I found you completely by accident. As far as I know, no one is looking for you. I wished I could gesture, wave her away.
Why are you here, then? It's not groundwork for an annexation. There aren't any more. That's what they told me.
No more annexations, I agreed. But that's not the point. The point is, you can come or go as you like. I have no orders to bring you back. Cyverdon considered that for 6 seconds and then said,
I tried to quit before. I did quit. This station I was on had a program. You'd quit, they'd give you a job. One of their workers hauled me in and cleaned me up and told me the deal. The job was crap, the deal was bullshit, but I'd had enough. I thought I'd had enough.
How long did you last?
Not quite 6 months.
You see, I said, after a 2-second pause, why I don't exactly have confidence in you this time.
Believe me, I do. But this is different.
She leaned forward, earnest. Nothing quite clarifies your thoughts like thinking you're about to die.
The effect is often temporary.
They said, back on that station, that they could give me something to make Kef never work on me. But first I had to fix whatever had made me take it to begin with, because otherwise I'd just find something else. Bullshit, like I said. But if I'd really wanted to, really meant to, I'd have done it then.
Back at Trigan's, she'd spoken as though her reason for starting was simple, clear-cut. "Did you tell them why you started?" She didn't answer.
"Did you tell them who you were?" "Of course not."
The two questions were the same in her mind, I guessed. "You faced death back at Garced." She flinched, just slightly.
"And everything changed. I woke up, and all I had was past. Not a very good past, either. No one liked telling me what had happened. Everyone was so polite and cheerful, and it was all fake, and I couldn't see any kind of future. Listen."
She leaned forward, earnest, breathing slightly harder.
"You're out here on your own, all by yourself, and obviously it's because you're suited to it, or you wouldn't have been assigned."
She paused a moment, maybe considering that issue of just who was suited to what, who was assigned where, and dismissing it.
"But in the end, you can go back to the Ratch and find people who know you, people who remember you personally, a place where you fit, even if you're not always there. No matter where you go, you're still part of that pattern. Even if you never go back, you always know it's there. But when they opened that suspension pod, anyone who ever had any personal interest in me was already 700 years dead. Probably longer. Not even."
Her voice trembled, and she stopped, staring ahead at some fixed point beyond me.
"Even the ships."
"Even the ships?"
"Ships? More than just Sword of Nathtas." The first ship I ever served on. Justice of Torren. I thought maybe, if I could find where it was stationed, I could send a message and..."
She made a negating gesture, wiping out the rest of that sentence.
"It disappeared. About 15 years ago."
"Closer to 20.
"Nobody could tell me what happened. Nobody knows."
"Were any of the ships you served on particularly fond of you?" I asked, voice carefully even, neutral. She blinked, straightened.
"That's an odd question. Do you have any experience with ships?"
"Yes," I said. "Actually?"
"Ships are always attached to their captains."
"Not like they used to be.
Not like when some ships had gone mad on the deaths of their captains. That had been long, long ago.
And even so, they have favourites.
Though a favourite wouldn't necessarily know it.
But it doesn't matter, does it? Ships aren't people, and they're made to serve you, to be attached, as you put it." Cyvedon frowned.
"Now you're angry. You're very good at hiding it, but you're angry."
"Do you grieve for your ships?" I asked. "Because they're dead? Or because their loss means they aren't here to make you feel connected and cared about?" Silence. "Or do you think those are the same thing?" Still no answer. "I will answer my own question. You were never a favourite of any of the ships you served on. You don't believe it's possible for a ship to have favourites." Cyvedon's eyes widened. Maybe surprise, maybe something else.
"You know me too well for me to believe you aren't here because of me." "I've thought so from the moment I actually started thinking about it."
"Not too long ago, then," I said. She ignored what I had just said.
"You're the first person since that pod opened to feel familiar, like I recognize you, like you recognize me. I don't know why that is."
I knew, of course. But this was not the moment to say so, to explain, immobilized and vulnerable as I was. "I assure you I'm not here because of you. I'm here on my own personal business."
"You jumped off that bridge for me."
"And I'm not going to be your reason for quitting Kef. I take no responsibility for you. You're going to have to do that yourself, if you really are going to do that?
You jumped off that bridge for me. That had to be a 3 kilometer drop, higher. That's...
She stopped, shaking her head.
I'm staying with you.
I closed my eyes. The moment I even think you're going to steal from me again, I will break both your legs and leave you there, and it will be utter coincidence if you ever see me again. Except that to Ratchai, there were no coincidences.
I guess I can't really argue with that.
I don't recommend it. She gave a short laugh, and then was silent for 15 seconds.
Tell me then, Breck,
she said after that.
If you're here on personal business, and nothing at all to do with me, why do you have one of the Ghar Sedai guns in your pack?
The correctives held my arms and legs completely immobile. I couldn't even get my shoulders off the bed. The doctor came heavily into the room, pale, flushed.
Lie still,
she admonished, and then turned to Cyverdon.
What did you do?
This was apparently comprehensible to Cyverdon. She spread her hands in a helpless gesture.
Not,
she replied vehemently, in the same language. The doctor frowned, pointed at Cyverdon, one finger out. Cyverdon straightened, indignant at the gesture, which was much ruder to a Ratchai than it was here.
You bother, the doctor said sternly. You go.
Then she turned to me.
You will lie still and heal properly.
Yes, doctor. I subsided from the very small amount of movement I had managed. Took a breath, attempting to calm myself. This seemed to mollify her. She watched me a moment, doubtless seeing my heart rate, my breathing.
If you can't settle, I can give you medication.
An offer, a question, a threat.
I can make him,
with a glance at Cyverdon,
leave.
I don't need it. Either one. The doctor gave a skeptical, and turned and left the room.
I'm sorry,
said Cyverdon when the doctor was gone.
That was stupid. I should have thought before I spoke.
I didn't answer.
When we got to the bottom,
she continued, as though it was logically connected to what she had said before.
You were unconscious, and obviously badly injured, and I was afraid to move you much because I couldn't see if maybe bones were broken. I didn't have any way to call for help, but I thought maybe you had something I could use to help climb out, or maybe some first aid correctives I could use, but of course that was foolish, your armor was still up, which was how I knew you were still alive. I did take your handheld out of your coat, but there was no signal. I had to climb up to the top before I could reach anyone. When I got back, your armor was down, and I was afraid you were dead. Everything's still in there.
If the gun is gone, I said, voice calm and neutral, I won't just break your legs.
It's there,
she insisted.
But this can't possibly be personal business, can it?
It's personal. It was just that with me, personal affected a great many others. But how could I explain that without revealing more than I wanted to just now?
Tell me.
This was not a good time, not a good moment, but there was a great deal to explain, especially since Cyverdon's knowledge of the past 1,000 years of history was sure to be patchy and superficial. Years of previous events leading up to this, which he would almost certainly be ignorant of, which would take time to explain, before I ever got to who I was and what I intended. And that history would make a difference. Without understanding it, how could Cyverdon understand anything? Without that context, how could she understand why anyone had acted as they did? If Anna Andamir Na'ai had not reacted with such fury to the Ghar Sedai, would she have done the things she'd done in the 1,000 years since then? If Lieutenant Orne had never heard of the events at Ime 5 years before, 25 years ago now, would she have acted as she did? When I imagined it,
The moment that Mercy of Sarse soldier had chosen to defy her orders, I saw her as a segment of an ancillary unit. She had been number one of Mercy of Sarse's Ama'at unit, its senior member. Even though she had been human, had had a name beyond her place on her ship, beyond Mercy of Sarse 1 Ama'at 1. But I had never seen a recording, had never seen her face. She had been human. She had endured events at Ime, perhaps even enforced the corrupt dictates of the governor herself when ordered. But something about that particular moment had changed things. Something had been too much for her. What had it been? The sight, perhaps, of a Ur, dead or dying. I'd seen pictures of the Ur, snake long, furred, multi-limbed, speaking in growls and barks, and the humans associated with them, who could speak that language and understand it. Had it been the Ur who had knocked Mercy of Sarse 1 Ama'at 1 off her expected path? Did she care so much for the threat of breaking the treaty with the Preska? Or had it been the thought of killing so many helpless human beings? If I had known more about her, perhaps I could have seen why in that moment she had decided that she would rather die. I knew almost nothing about her, probably by design. But even the little I had known, the little Lieutenant Orne had known, had made a difference. "Did anyone tell you about what happened at Ime Station?" Cyvedon frowned.
"No. Tell me."
I told her. About the governor's corruption, her preventing Ime Station or any of the ships from reporting what she was doing, so far from anywhere else in Ratch space. About the ship that had arrived one day. They'd assumed it was human. No one knew of any aliens anywhere nearby, and it obviously wasn't Ratch-Eye. And so it was fair game. I told Cyvedon as much as I knew about the soldiers from Mercy of Sarse, who boarded the unknown ship with orders to take it and kill anyone aboard who resisted or who obviously couldn't be made into ancillaries. I didn't know much, only that once the one Ama'at unit had boarded the alien ship, its one had refused to continue to follow orders. She had convinced the rest of one Ama'at to follow her, and they had defected to the Ur and taken the ship out of reach. Cyvedon's frown only deepened, and when I was done she said,
"So, you're telling me the governor of Ime was completely corrupt, and somehow had the accesses to prevent Ime Station from reporting her? How does that happen?"
I didn't answer. Either the obvious conclusion would occur to her, or she would be unable to see it.
"And how could the aptitudes have put her in such a position, if she was capable of that? It isn't possible."
"Of course," Cyvedon continued.
"Everything else follows from that, doesn't it? A corrupt governor appoints corrupt officials, never mind the aptitudes. But the captain stationed there, no, it isn't possible."
She wouldn't be able to see it. I shouldn't have said anything at all. When that soldier refused to kill the Ur who had come into the system, when she convinced the rest of her unit to do likewise, she created a situation that could not be concealed for long. The Ur could generate their own gate, so the governor couldn't prevent them from leaving. They had only to make a single jump to the next inhabited system and tell their story. Which was exactly what they did.
"Why did anyone care about the Ur?"
Cyvedon couldn't quite get her throat around the sound.
"Seriously, they're called that?"
"It's what they call themselves," I explained in my most patient voice.
"When Ur said it, or one of their human translators, it sounded like a sustained growl, not much different from any other Ur speech."
"It's kind of hard to say. Most people I've heard just say a long R sound."
"Ur,"
Cyvedon said, experimentally.
"Still sounds funny. So why did anyone care about the Ur?"
"Because the Preska had made a treaty with us on the basis of their having decided humans were significant. Killing the insignificant is nothing to the Preska, and violence between members of the same species means nothing to them, but indiscriminate violence towards other significant species is unacceptable." Not to say no violence is allowed, but it's subject to certain conditions, none of which make obvious sense to most humans, so it's safest just to avoid it altogether. Cyverdon made a breathy, huh, pieces falling into place. So then, I continued, the entire one Amaat unit of Mercy of Sase had defected to the Ur. They were out of reach, safe with the aliens. But to the Rat'ai, they were guilty of treason. It might have been better just to leave them where they were, but instead, the Ratch demanded them back, so they could be executed. And of course the Ur didn't want to do that. The one Amaat unit had saved their lives. Things were very tense for several years, but eventually they compromised. The Ur handed over the unit leader, the one who'd started the mutiny, in exchange for immunity for the others.
But...
Cyverdon stopped. After 7 seconds of silence, I said, you're thinking that of course she had to die. No disobedience can be tolerated, for very good reasons. But at the same time, her treason exposed the governor of Ime's corruption, which otherwise would have continued unabated. So ultimately, she did the Ratch a service. You're thinking that any fool knows better than to speak up and criticize a government official for any reason. And you're thinking that if anyone who speaks up to criticize something obviously evil is punished merely for speaking, civilization is in a bad way. No one will speak who isn't willing to die for her speech. And, I hesitated, swallowed, there aren't many willing to do that. You're probably thinking that the Lord of the Ratch was in a difficult spot, deciding how to handle the situation, but also that these particular circumstances were extraordinary, and Ana'anda Mianna'ai is, in the end, the ultimate authority, and might have pardoned her if she wished.
I'm thinking, said Cyverdon, that the Lord of the Ratch could have just let them stay with the Ur and been free of the whole mess.
She could have, I agreed.
I'm also thinking that if I were the Lord of the Ratch, I would never have let that news get much farther than Ime.
You'd use accesses to prevent ships and stations from talking about it, maybe. You'd forbid any citizens who knew to say anything.
Yes, I would.
But it would still spread, by rumour, though that rumour would of necessity be vague and slow-moving. And you'd lose the very instructive example you could make, letting everyone watch you line up nearly all of Ime's administration on the station concourse and shoot them in the head, one after the other. And of course, Cyverdon was a single person, who was thinking of Ana'anda Mianna'ai as a single person who could be undecided about such things, but then choose a single course of action without dividing herself over her decision. And there was a great deal more behind Ana'anda Mianna'ai's dilemma than Cyverdon had grasped. Cyverdon was silent for 4 seconds and then said,
Now I'm going to make you angry again.
Really? I asked dryly. Aren't you getting tired of that?
Yes.
Simply. Seriously. The governor of Ime was well-born and well-bred, I said, and named her house.
Never heard of them, said Cyverdon. There've been so many changes. Now things like this happening, you honestly don't think there's a connection?
I turned my head away without lifting it. Not angry, just very, very tired. You mean to say none of this would have happened if jumped-up provincials hadn't been jumped up? If the governor of Ime had been from a family of real, proven quality? Cyverdon had wit enough not to answer. You've honestly never known anyone born better to be assigned or promoted past their ability? To crack under pressure? Behave badly?
Not like that.
Fair enough. But she'd conveniently forgotten that Mercy of Sase One Amaat One, human, not an ancillary, would also have been jumped up, by her definition, was part of the very change Cyverdon had mentioned. Jumped-up provincials, and the sort of thing that happened at Ime, are both results of the same events. One did not cause the other. She asked the obvious question.
What caused it, then?
The answer was too complicated. How far back to begin? It started at Garsed. It started when the Lord of the Ratch multiplied herself and set out to conquer all of human space. It started when the Ratch was built. And further back. I'm tired, I said.
Of course,
said Cyverdon, more equably than I had expected.
We can talk about it later.